Good morning. I would like to call the Senate Education Committee to order at 8 a.m. Today is Wednesday, February 8th. Hard to believe that it's already that far into the session. Today we have present Senator Geisel, Senator Begich, and Senator Stevens, and Senator Coghill may be along. He is with the justices at this point. And the early morning cell phone reminder, you know what to do. And thanks to Nancy Jones and Ben Manley that we have assisting us. We appreciate you. We're going to hear today from the University of Alaska President, Jim Johnson. And there's been a lot of work going on, led by the new president, to improve education and control cost. And included in these efforts is the Strategic Pathways Initiative, where the ultimate goals are to improve graduation rates and meet the demand for workers in the industry that keeps Alaska's economy growing. Very important at this particular stage of the game in Alaska. So I look forward to hearing an update of the efforts and the work that's underway. And President Johnson, if you would begin your presentation. Now, I noticed that it's a pretty lengthy PowerPoint, but because there are a few of us, as long as we can keep moving, we can entertain questions during the PowerPoint, if that's all right with you.
I sure hope so, Senator.
And then if we see we're going to run out of time, we may stop that. But we've had a series of lots of presenters and joint meetings where we've had to hold questions to the end, so it's kind of going to be nice today to be a slightly more relaxed in that. So members, if you have questions, just get my attention. Thank you, President. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Johnson, President of the University of Alaska. Our mission. I think it's critically important to begin any presentation about the University of Alaska or any organization for that matter with our mission and our purpose. And this describes the mission of the entire University of Alaska system. And it's, in one sense, a very standard mission statement for a state university system. And you would see this in Iowa or Florida, the emphasis on our tripartite mission of teaching, research, and public service. And this is typical of land-grant universities ever since the Morrill Act was signed in 1862. But at the same time, we have something unique about our mission statement here that you don't see in Iowa or Florida, and that is the emphasis on the North and the emphasis on the diverse peoples of Alaska. And so I think this captures both the continuity and our involvement and belonging to the larger land-grant university community across the country and that great history, but also the emphasis on Alaska, the North, and our people here in the state.
President Johnson, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment to welcome Senator Coghill and get that on the record that he's present.
Senator, good to see you. How's that wing of yours?
Yeah, doing well.
All right, good. So this, our education, research, and service, the three major parts of our mission, the academic mission in our classrooms and in our laboratories and in our shops all across the state, research that happens not only in laboratories, but as you see in this little photograph here, that happens in the field, on the waters, on the mountains, all across this great land. And then service, how we reach out to people in Alaska and share the fruit of what our faculty, students, and staff do every day. We have a proud history. In the summer of 1915, territorial delegate James Wickersham and some Fairbanksons got together and poured a big chunk of concrete and put some initials on it, Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. And that was on July 4th, by the way. And they really were, of course, interested in statehood. And they felt, hey, we can create a university here. We can have a state. And it was a great day because not only did that occur on what is now the UAF campus, but territorial delegate Wickersham also met with the traditional Tanana chiefs that day. And they talked about a lot of things, but one of the things the chiefs really emphasized to Delegate Wickersham was the importance of education. And so it's really a remarkable day, I think, and a proud day for Alaska that these two cultures really came together, and they came together at that place. Well, fast forward 100 years. A couple of years ago, we celebrated the pouring of that that cornerstone. And then, of course, this year, 2017, is the 100th anniversary of the territorial legislature's adoption of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. So we actually have a nice a little setup here for the next 6 years. We've got 100th anniversaries. The founding by the legislature in 17, the construction of our first building, I believe that was in about 19. The opening, well, it didn't have any operating funds, so they boarded it up for a year or so. Not an old story. We experience it today, too. But then in 1922, the opening of the campus and the first graduate in 1923. And I'll foreshadow something that I think is very interesting. We lead the country today in the percentage of our population with some college and no degree. Well, our first graduate had 3 years of college and no degree, and President Bunnell, the first president of the university, said, "Hey, John Shanley, I need somebody to walk across the stage here." And so he was able to help Mr. Shanley finish off his degree. So it's really interesting how our first graduate there really does foreshadow a tremendous opportunity we still have today in Alaska in terms of educating our people. So, I say this in many public presentations, it takes a great university to create a great state, a great city, a great community, whatever it might be. And it's just a simple truth, and we've known it all across this country, and we know it all across the world. So I think it's critically important to keep that front and center in everything we do. I touched on a couple of these, from one campus back in 1922 to 15 campuses today, from Ketchikan in southeast Alaska all the way up above the Arctic Circle in Kotzebue. Mr. Shanley was our first graduate back in 1923. North of 4,600 graduates last year walked across stages at the University of Alaska. We're very proud to be the number one higher education institution in Alaska by far and away. We're the number one higher education institution in the United States in terms of affordability, if you take our tuition and divide it into average household income. So we think that's critically important to make higher education and its opportunities available to Alaskans. Quite a few of our students are first-time college going, and so it's critical that we make it possible for them to attend.
President Johnson, when you divide it into the average household, is that the average household salary for Alaska, or is that national?
We compare to Alaskans, so we actually have pretty high average household income, so that denominator does help us with that, but it's a standard measure used all across the country. We're also very, very proud to be the world's number one research university on the Arctic, on Arctic subjects. And that's critically important, not just because it feels good to say it, and it feels good to, as an Alaskan, to be able to have that. But it's critically important in terms of Alaskans. It's our workforce. It's our people who are doing that tremendous world-class work. It's great for our reputation, attracts graduate students and interest of others around the world. But it also really improves what happens in our classrooms, the quality of what happens in our classrooms, very important. And it also helps us solve problems. The work that our scientists are doing is not simply what some federal agency is paying us to do. A lot of it is critically important for our state and how we manage infrastructure in a changing climate, the social impacts, political impacts of all of that. So it's a real treasure, and I'll talk a little bit more about our thinking about research going forward in a few minutes. So we're here to meet Alaska's needs. We're not the University of Iowa. We're the University of Alaska. We're the university for Alaska. That's our mission. That's our purpose. And so we really need to broaden access to higher education for Alaskans. We are, if you compare us to other states, we have relatively low college attainment, college completion, and that's a real important emphasis for us and for our state going forward. As our economy changes, the one thing that's just true is that our future and the quality of our future is a function of the quality of the talent that we have in our people, whether it's talent in our mines, whether it's talent working as process technicians in the fisheries industry, whether it's talent working on a pipeline or a gas line or whatever it might be. Talent is the competitive advantage, and we've got to invest in that. Our research, not only, again, do we focus on the theoretical, but on the practical. You all know of the very good work of ICER. You know of the good work of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, which has no tenured faculty in it. It's all folks who are interested in solving problems for Alaskan communities. The Center for Alaska Native Health Research has the top level, top tier of National Institutes of Health grant to look at behavioral health issues among our Alaska Native population. The Institute of Northern Engineering does tremendous work and will actually do even more of that once we finish off the engineering building at Fairbanks. It has some one-of-a-kind facilities in Alaska there, so that some of the research that DOT might do outside of Alaska, bridge testing, for example, some big materials stuff can be done right here in Alaska. So that's very, very important and practical. Preparing Alaskans for our high-demand jobs, you know, teachers, nurses, you know, I've said it many times, and you know the numbers. We import 70% of the new teachers hired every year in Alaska, and that's simply not a good long-term plan for, in my view, and I'm not pandering to any members of this committee, the single most important job in our state, and we need to grow our own teachers. Diverse knowledge-based economy, we don't score real well when it comes to a new economy or the knowledge economy. We've had a great experience with natural resource economy. That's been very, very important for us and has made us a very wealthy state. But more IT, engineering, finance, and even the liberal arts. Frankly, a lot of businesses are led by people with history degrees and liberal arts degrees and philosophy degrees. So that's important as well. We've really got to strengthen the pipeline, to use an Alaska metaphor, between our K-12 and the university. And I'll speak more about that in just a moment, but that's a top priority for us. And then diversifying our revenues, you know, as the state goes, so we go. And just as the state really, in my view, needs to diversify revenues and become more cost-effective at the same time, we do too. And you'll see in my remarks here in a while our plans for doing just that. Well, we're an awful big state. You know it well. You've seen the map of Alaska transposed onto the lower 48 states. We touch the two oceans. When I go to meetings of my colleagues across the country, I say we've got a campus in South Carolina, we've got one in Iowa, we've got one in South Dakota, and we've got one in Oklahoma. And of our 15 campuses, half are not accessible by land. So it's a tremendous geographic spread, and it's a great advantage for us. It can also be a challenge. This map identifies just a number of our centers across the state. I think it doesn't show a couple of things. One is the research that's happening in many places all across the state. It doesn't show the extent of service that's being provided to Alaskans across all the big swath of our great state. And finally, through online education, it doesn't show that we've got students all in that blank area there who are taking classes from the University of Alaska. But we're all over this place, and it's all about serving Alaska. Big benefits. We had the McDowell Group do a study last year, and they looked at the economic impact of the university. And as you see there, roughly 16,000 jobs result from our work here. North of $1 billion in annual economic impact. Rural Alaska, north of $40 million a year. That's significant.
Senator Begich?
Good to see you here, Jim. I just wanted to ask a quick question about quantifying some of those research impacts on this economic picture you describe here. What impact does your research activity have, or have you quantified that for the number of jobs that are created as part of the UA engine?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, we can get back to you. I would say that we can get back to you with a ratio there. You're thinking just in workforce itself?
Yeah. When we can certainly talk about 15,740 sure. jobs result from UA activities.
Yep.
Senator Begich.
Madam Chair. Is there a way that we can quantify the impact that the research component of UA is having? I mean, I understand that it has a significant impact, and I want to be able to quantify that, so you know, for those who have asked me about that same question.
Through the chair, Senator Begich. I think what I'd offer there is to get back to you and to members of the committee with two responses. One would look at the workforce impacts itself, and then simply the spending, because our researchers don't simply hire and pay salaries with research. They buy helicopter rides. They contract with the private sector to do work. So we can follow up and provide estimates of the economic value. And of course, the third one that I want to be able to report to you more on, and in a few years I'll happily do that. And that is the number of startups, the number of jobs that have been created in the private sector directly from the commercialization of intellectual property. That's a top priority for us moving forward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Begich.
I asked that question, of course, as a person holding a history degree from University of Alaska Systems.
Yes, and it's expanding. Senator Begich, just want to point the last bullet there. It does talk about research, but we're wanting to know direct and indirect jobs. And I'm very interested, too, in the commercialization. I don't know if you're going to be talking about that later, or are we going to get an update on what's happening?
Madam Chair, I'll touch on that. Yes.
Okay, great.
I like this chart because it, sort of represents the big picture of the leadership of the University of Alaska. I don't like it because it looks like I'm the center of the universe, and that's simply not true. It helps, identify my bosses, 11 of them, the regents of the University of Alaska. Of course, they were included in the constitution of the state when it was established, they're, again, my 11 bosses. They're tremendous Alaskans who put in 8 years of service. And, in fact, we have one regent who's looking at her third term, which is pretty remarkable, frankly. But the extent of service, and especially the last couple of years, have been bumpy years and have really required a great deal of time and focus from those public servants. We at the statewide administration just want to point out two major responsibilities we have. One is to ensure that the state's needs for higher education are met in the most cost-effective possible way. So the state's needs. And while our campuses certainly have interests in and look to the state's needs, often their interests are regional, and that's legitimate and correct. They should be. But in this system, our real focus at the statewide system is the state's needs being met. And then second, to provide cost-effective administrative services to the campuses. So general counsel, for example, we don't have lawyers on our campuses. They're all at the system level. Our lands office, we don't have lands people on the campuses. They're at the system office. There are a number of offices like that where there aren't redundant bureaucrats. I would note also, just to throw this out now, over the last couple of years, our campuses have taken 14% budget cuts as a result of general fund reductions. At the statewide office, it's been 29%. So that's just note. We have been looking hard at the statewide administration and reducing it.
President, the 29% reduction, is that over 2 years? Or?
Yes, it is.
Three.
Yep. And I'll talk about it in a little while. We're looking at more. So students come first at the University of Alaska. And so you see the number of air enrolled. It's about a little north of 30,000. Now, this is a decline. Our peak year was 2011, and we had about 35,000 students across the system at that time. And even in a bigger time frame, over the last 40 years, if you divide our enrollment into the state's population, because the state's population has grown so much and our enrollment has not, the percentage of the state's population at the University of Alaska has declined from 6.3% to 4.3%. So that causes me concern when I think about our importance for the state, that essentially we've had a 30% reduction in the percentage of Alaskans who are studying at our university. And so that adds a bit of urgency, I assure you, to our work in the enrollment area.
Senator Begich.
President Johnson, what do you ascribe that decline to? What do you account for that? How do you account for that decline?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, I think several things. One is the rest of the country pulling out of the Great Recession. So I think that's a consideration there. Our economy was pretty strong, in 11. Now, we would think that as our economy heads south, that enrollment would be stepping up right now, and that hasn't occurred. So that's another thing that we've asked McDowell Group to look into for us. I'll touch on that in a little bit, but they're investigating that issue right now. I'd say a third, just quickly, is the real rise of online high-quality programs from outside. It drives me bonkers. How many advertisements I hear from Arizona State University, right, or the Foster School of Management at the University of Washington. We're moving out in those areas, but I think that's part of it. They have been very, very aggressive, and they're marketing here in Alaska because it makes sense to market here in Alaska. There's demand, and so I think that's part of it as well. Let's see. There's that number again in FY15, 4,678 degree certificate endorsements. A lot of folks and graduations, and I would commend them if you haven't had a chance. I know some of you actually went through graduation at our university, but I would really commend that. We deal with budgets and we deal with organization charts and all of that, but that day in May, wherever you are in the state, when students walk across the stage, is very, very special, and I'd encourage you to participate in that. We have a largely part-time student population. Something like 60% of our students are part-time, so folks are working most of the time through their college careers. We have only about 8% of our students are grad students, and that's an area of emphasis, I think, to grow in that area. And quite a few of those graduate students come from outside Alaska. So that's a positive, but I think there's real opportunity there. And then the final point here is 27% of our students come from minority racial background, and we're going to drive that number up, but that's a good number, and 15% from Alaska Native communities across the state. So we're very proud to be the number one destination, higher educational destination for Alaska Native people. So who our students aren't, I mentioned it just a little while ago, and I'll give you more detailed numbers in just a minute. Our students aren't the 115,000 Alaskans with some college and no degree. So it's important to know who we are and who we aren't so that we can go after those folks who are not our students at this point.
Madam Chair, may I?
Senator Beckett.
There was a recent article, President Johnson, about the increased number of remediation needed in the college system, in our UA system. I just saw this a couple of days ago, and I'm wondering, are you struggling with students coming to the university that are unprepared? And if so, have you given some thought to how we might address that?
Through the chair, Senator Bakich, we are struggling with that and have for years. We're in an open admission institution, and as a result, you come, we take you. We're improving right now. There's some real interesting innovations across the university system to try to bring down the level of developmental education that's required for incoming students. The work we're doing with dual enrollment, collaborating with high schools across the state, is a great example. The Matsu Middle College High School, College Middle School, those young people are graduating from high school with 30 university credits. They require zero developmental education, and 75% of them attend a University of Alaska campus. So that's an innovation right there that is a real positive. The Math Emporium, UAA, for example, is employing the Math Emporium, which is self-paced math courses, so there isn't a professor standing up in front from 10 to 11:30 Tuesdays and Thursdays. It's an open area with self-paced math courses and math teachers, grad students, and others around to help students. Brings costs down, and it's improving student outcomes. So those are a couple of innovations that are addressing this issue. That recent study, I think, is a reminder. What it does is really look at each high school and sort of drill down into each high school and school district across the state, and also brings in GPA. So to what extent are students with pretty strong GPAs not ready for college? Now, we can take those data and be critical, or as I choose to do and as Commissioner Michael Johnson of DEED chooses to do, we take those as a challenge and an opportunity to work together so that he is leading the K-12 system and the 53 school districts across the state to strengthen readiness for work or college. And our job is to make sure that we're producing more of the state's very, very best teachers in that effort.
I take that as a challenge, too. Did you have a as far as working that out? Because in that transcript study, one of the things I was concerned about was how high the GPAs were, and they were still needing the remedial work, and even the fact that they had taken, for instance, Algebra 2 in high school, but then they had to go back to remedial math when they got to college. So something is off, out of alignment there, and we do need to fix that for the sake of our students. One of the questions I had, because of the scholarship program, and I don't remember the breakdown, but is somebody that is, are some of those students that have the 3.2, the 3.5, and need remedial coursework, are some of those students coming in using the scholarship?
Madam Chair, I believe that's probably the case. I don't have specific numbers available. That's something that we can provide, I believe, but I don't have that right off the top of my head.
Okay.
But it is that's part of the problem here. If a young person is recognized as a scholar and as someone who's very successful, and then they come to us and they're in a developmental course, which means not for credit.
Right.
So they're spending money, they're spending time, and they're not getting credit. That's not an empowering message to send to a young person. So we need to address that.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And along those lines, it's such an enormous problem. I appreciate your working with Dr. Johnson and trying to Johnson & Johnson. I appreciate that comment. This is a persistent problem we've had for years at the university. And I've always wondered why we can't do more. Because a student will take a three-credit class at the university, no credit, doesn't count. They pay for it, and it doesn't get into a degree. Have you looked into online classes, summer workshops, ways to bring young people up to speed before they actually move onto the campus?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, absolutely, and that's an area that we really need to step up even more. We do have some great examples of programs that are addressing this preparation issue. You're all familiar with the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. Those young people show up on our campuses, they're ready to rock. So that's a positive. The Rawhide program is another example, Rural Alaskans Honors Institute. Again, they are all showing up on our campuses with credits, and they're ready to go to study. But I think in the online area, that's the Math Emporium, for example, at Anchorage needs to be expanded to provide more of that opportunity. You do see that at other institutions across the country where these math emporiums are open 24/7, and they're not on campus, they're off campus, they're in a shopping mall. They're where the people are. That way it's convenient that that young person can actually be cutting grass or doing something during the summertime, and then also after work or on a weekend pop in and get ready for coursework. More work to be done in that area, no question about that. And I should say our faculty are very interested in doing that as well. We have developmental faculty across the system who are focused on this, and the Regents, too. They commissioned a group of faculty to focus in on this issue. It's expensive for us, and it's more expensive not only in financial terms but in non-financial terms to our students, and that's what concerns me. If we're putting barriers up in front of people, intentional or not, we need to look at those barriers and knock them down to ensure our students are moving forward.
President Johnson, has there been any effort to kind of, rather than the person coming in and taking the remedial course, to merge and actually have them take the 100-level class, provide a tremendous amount of support so that they're only paying for those three credits, and they're part of the disturbing thing is about the students that take remedial classes, their chances of going through to graduation are much less from what I've read. So has there been any effort to go ahead and get them in the 100-level class but provide the extra coaching and support, and would that work?
Madam Chair, it's an excellent question. You're right. I think the success rates, ultimate success rates, are single digits of the current model. And we are looking very closely at exactly what you're talking about, getting them in and then really providing the supports necessary for them to succeed. So four-credit course with other students who are succeeding. They're not in the dumb person's math, and I don't mean that negatively, but you know, they're not in that, but that's how it's often perceived. So it's controversial, I should say, across the country, but this is actually the direction that universities are heading, is to get them in, support them, so that they can succeed with everyone else.
Okay, thank you. Continue, please.
Thanks. Looking here, sort of to Senator Begich's interest here, a little bit more on the economic power of research, and again, we'll provide more on this in follow-up to your questions. In terms of the efficiency of our research machine, for each dollar the state puts in, we bring back $4.10. And there are some areas that are much more efficient than this, actually. You put a buck in, you're going to get $6-7 into the University of Alaska and into the economy here. We are experiencing increased disclosures, invention disclosures across the system. What we haven't done as good enough job as I want at this point, we can talk more about that, is really getting those things on the street and creating businesses. We do have some examples of businesses, but we need to do much, much more of that to contribute to diversification in our economy. And there are folks in the private sector who really want to partner with us on that. So when I think about Fairbanks, drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, what can we do to, and I want a factory across the street that's producing those things, or is making apps for controlling optics for those, and Anchorage, you know, there we are right across the street from the state's center for healthcare. What are we doing, right there that is bringing together the power that comes from the confluence of those major parts of our community? Southeast, there's actually a professor here who's working on seaweed and innovative uses for food purposes. What can we do to commercialize that? So we do have folks there, but we've got to do a better job, frankly, of supporting them and encouraging their work. So more to come on that one, but it's a high priority for us. Now, here are just a few of the research centers across the university. There are 60 of them. A couple of others that I'd note that are critically important: the Institute of Arctic Biology, which operates the nation's only Arctic terrestrial research facility up above the Arctic Circle at Tulik Lake. The Institute for Marine Science, which operates across the state. A new center funded by the Federal Department of Homeland Security, which is doing a fantastic job, is the Arctic Domain Awareness Center, which does a lot of work for particularly the Coast Guard and others who need awareness as they operate in the Arctic domain. So very important work there. And you see a lot of things that are critically, they're relevant to Alaska: energy, power, volcanoes, ocean acidification, ICER, et cetera. So a lot of real tremendous work that's being done by our researchers across the state, certainly at Fairbanks, which is our leading research university, but very important work at Anchorage and here at Southeast as well. And indeed, on a couple of our community campuses, while it's not core to their mission, we do have folks who do research there as well.
Senator Stevenson.
Mr. President, you went off one of my favorite research centers, the FITC in Kodiak. I know that was not done purposely, but I think I need to thank you for the impact that the FITC has had on Kodiak. The fishing industry has been changing over the years. Pollock fishery is now one of the biggest volume of fish. And the whole development of what's called surimi, mm-hmm. Producing a pollock into fish blocks that are then very popular in the Orient, that has really changed the industry. And that's what we're doing now. Our fish plants in Kodiak are producing surimi only because the Fish Tech Center found the way to do it.
Through the chair, thank you very much, Senator Stevens. We are committed to the ongoing success of that particular research facility. I want to commend the community of Kodiak for working with us on that. It's a challenging situation, but we're working closely together with folks there. I'd like to share with you that we've got a team of leaders, UAF leaders and statewide leaders who will be heading to the community in the next month to continue our work with the community to try to make sure that applied research center continues to serve the industry there. So, thank you. So looking forward, we've got to keep the focus on Arctic research. It is happening here now. So we need to own it. We don't need to outsource to Harvard or Berkeley or those folks the work that's being done in the north. I talked about some of the strategic work. This unmanned aerial vehicles is critical in terms of taking advantage of our strategic global position. The Arctic Domain Awareness Center touches on the support we're providing to operators in the north, support for startups and other companies in the state, critically important, and then really doing work that impacts the lives of Alaskans through health research. We joke a little bit. We have world-class researchers on hibernation studies, bears and Arctic ground squirrels in particular. And, it's interesting when you bring these things out because actually some of the ground squirrels are in labs and they are in freezers. And you bring them out and they're alive, but they're frozen. And so we kid about them and they're cute and all of that. But it's critically important work to really understand the mechanism for how this happens, that these, their bodies actually get to, 32F. And how they regenerate metabolism and heartbeat and all of that. NIH is keenly interested in this for stroke recovery purposes. The Defense Department has funded a lot of that research in terms of treatment of battlefield injury. So, again, you think it's just a ground squirrel, cute, but it's actually really, really important work that our scientists are doing. Service. Thousands and thousands of Alaskans benefit from this third part of our land grant mission, from 4-H and youth development to ag to master gardening, et cetera, et cetera. I should say one of the most excited presentations to the Board of Regents in my time as president came from the Master Gardeners in Anchorage when there were some tweaks being made to how we were serving that community. And those folks are committed. There's no question about it. And they really, really rely on the work that our extension agents do. And I think you have, don't the 4-H and others, Future Farmers of Alaska students come here, I think, and couldn't be more proud of those young people. They're absolutely excellent examples of our future, I think that's a product of some of the great work that our people in the extension do. So we've got a lot of great stuff happening at your university, but like our state, we face challenges, geographic challenges. Students, we've talked a little bit about our funnel. It's a challenged funnel. Low high school graduation rates, low college going rates, low readiness rates, very, very challenging for us. So we're facing up to it, but it's real, and we need to be honest about that.
I know I mentioned my concern about the remedial because they're less likely to graduate if they begin that route. But I'm gonna kind of have a devil's advocate question here. Do employers look for degrees as much in today's world as they did 10, 20, 30 years ago? In other words, when I think about learning with the internet, and it seems to be at the K-12 level a lot more about how to learn and where to go to find what you need, because the mass of knowledge is so immense now. And so are employers, for some things where you have to have a certain certificate or a certain degree, I get that. But in other areas, are employers looking more for a motivated student, a student that can adapt, a student that can get along with coworkers, or is that degree just as important? In other words, we're really concerned about the graduation rate and that we have students that aren't completing, but are we measuring the jobs that they're getting? Maybe the jobs that they get when they leave the campus is more important than whether they have a degree or not. Have you looked at that? Am I making sense?
Absolutely. It's it takes time to unpack that issue because it is there's a lot of complexity there. There's no question. Employers certainly do look for skills, and degrees and certificates do represent skill attainment, but not all the time. We have students who get poached out of our programs, particularly career and technical programs, prior to their receiving an associate's degree because they're ready to go and they're ready to start making money. And so that definitely happens. So employers are looking for skills, but to your point, they're also looking for adaptability, teamwork, honesty, ethics, the ability to learn, continuous learning, to acquire new facts and new skills as time goes on. And of course, traditionally, we have used the degree as the proxy for that. So there's a lot of innovation in the area now of stackable credentials, for example, in the IT world in particular. So, I have this Cisco certificate, or just to name one. Okay, you got a job. Now, how can you, university, help that young person move along and acquire more of these over time? So you're right that the degree itself is becoming less and less important, as opposed to some certificate, license, that sort of thing. And so in a moment, I'll talk about workforce demands as projected for 2025. And it's very broad in terms of degrees, certificates, that sort of thing. Some post-secondary education of value is really the coin of the realm. It's not necessarily a baccalaureate. It's not even necessarily an associate's degree. Now, that said, for a person's mobility and to move from one industry to another industry, frequently it really does help to have that degree, that training in research methods, for even at an undergraduate level. In many occupations, you may get a great job, for example, on the slope or in a process technology field or something like that, and start at ADK as a 21-year-old or 20-year-old even in some cases. But the room for growth is capped frequently in some of those occupations.
So. President Johnson, do you track the types of jobs that students are getting after they leave, whether they graduate or don't graduate? And is that something that's been tracked over time so that we can compare, so we'll better understand how important that degree or certificate is, or whether we're seeing that students, they're not completing, but maybe they are getting great job offers and it's comparable to what I don't know that it is, but I'm just wondering, do you measure that? Do you something as students exit to know and where they're going, what type of jobs and what type of pay they're receiving?
Madam Chair, we do track that. We are working with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development on that. So our partnerships here that are strengthening right now are with the Department of Education and Early Development and also the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Now, one thing that's critically important to remember is that our economy is changing. And while it's true that Alaskans have been able to obtain high-paying jobs that don't require high educational attainment, that's probably not sustainable for the long term. And so for us to be able to maintain our high incomes, it's our view that we've got to increase educational attainment. And that's not just here in Alaska. That's all across the United States. The concern is if we don't and our economy changes and those jobs are not as available, and we're seeing that today in our state, then our incomes will decline as we regress to the mean of the relationship between educational attainment and income. And that's a very strong analysis. 80% of the variance in income across the country is a function of educational attainment. We're a bit of an outlier, mm-hmm. along with Wyoming right now, another resource development state. But as our economy changes and we rely less and less and we have fewer and fewer of those jobs, that's going to be a serious challenge for us.
So you're working with the Department of Labor now, and you could get us some information on that. Is there historic information on that as well, as far as students leaving the campuses, whether graduating or not graduating, how they did on jobs, so that we can compare?
Madam Chair, I don't have that right on the top of my head. We will get what information we have on that. That's not a new problem, right,
okay,
or a new
you.
Issue. So. Thank you. Moving down through these challenges here, our structure is complex. You know, one of the advantages of having 15 campuses, is including the community campuses, is you're all across the state. A disadvantage is that you've got 15 campuses all across the state. And we've got multiple bureaucracies, and we're looking up. We're looking at that issue, but it is definitely a challenge for us. Budget, our heavy reliance on the state, among the highest in the country in percentage terms, and of course, budget reductions. That's a challenge for us. And related to that, and I'll address it in a little more depth in a moment, is our land grant deficit. We didn't get the land we were promised. Only Delaware got a smaller land grant than we did. And when you look at that over the period of decades, it's one explanation, I believe, for our heavier reliance on the state for funding as opposed to relying more on our own resources, including land.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, President Johnson, I want to tell you I'm a huge fan of the University of Alaska.
Thank you.
I grew up playing on the campus, and that was the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. That was the only campus in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I have my master's degree from the University of Alaska Anchorage. Mm-hmm. One of my sons has both his master's and bachelor's in electrical engineering from UAF.
Right.
Sitting in this room is a young man named Casey Bain, who is a student intern in my office. He
Right.
just made the chancellor's list. And one of my staff was one of your top debaters at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Ike G. Lopsis.
Mm-hmm.
So the university, in my view, is a jewel
mm-hmm.
for this state. My concern is that land grant deficit.
Yep.
What is the barrier to you getting your land grant?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, our Constitution. And our Constitution prohibits the dedication of funds, including land. And the Supreme Court ruled in 2009 that was the case. The legislature actually gave the university in 2005 250,000 acres to remedy the land grant deficit. That went to the Supreme Court on a separate issue, and the Legislature's Act was sustained at that time. And so land started getting transferred to the university in 06 and 07. The issue was relitigated, and the question put squarely before the court was, is land subject to the non-dedication clause of the Constitution? The court said yes, and so we started handing land back to the state. Now, there is an exception to this provision of the state's constitution, and that is except as required for participation in a federal program. So as we speak, we are working in Washington, D.C. To create that federal program or framework. Get that through, and that'll be a lot of hard work back there, obviously, to get through both houses of Congress and the White House and Department of Interior and all that, then we will be coming to you with a request for state participation in that federal program. So that's it's a two-step process at this point, but this has been an issue for decades, but we see a light here at the end of the tunnel. It's not going to benefit us Tuesday or Wednesday, but we think 10 years out it could really seriously benefit us. So thank you for your question.
And I have a question as follow-up to that. The federal program, if it goes through and everything lines up to the best that it can, will that remedy the entire all the acreage, that the whole thing or just part of it? Or?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know what the land selections will actually look like as part of the federal program. We'll want some, no question about that. But it's a partnership. And so once that framework gets set up at the federal level, including land or not, hopefully it does include some land, then we'll be coming to this body. But I appreciate the question because it's for your information. Heads up, we're working it. And that way we'll be coming to, we're about 250,000. If you look at the various federal statutes, what we're due, I believe it's 360,000 acres under the Morrill Act and other laws, and we got 110. thousand. So Rhode Island got a bigger land grant than we did. Connecticut, Massachusetts, little teeny states got bigger land grants than we did. So it's time to remedy that, and I'm very hopeful that we will.
Thank you. And I saw Senator Begich. I thought I had a question, but I think Senator Stevens maybe was before. Did you have a question, Senator Stevens?
Yes, about the can we go to accreditation for just a minute? Interesting topic. It's very expensive, time-consuming. I know there are three accredited institutions now. At one time, I think every campus had to get accredited on its own. Do you see some changes there? Is one university the right way to go, one accreditation, or do you see it continuing as three separate institutions?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, this is a really important question. I would note there are two, just for accreditation clarification, there are two types. One is programmatic accreditation, so of a business school or an engineering school or an education school. And the second is institutional accreditation, and that's what I believe you're referring to, Senator. The Regents also asked that question last year, and so I commissioned a study last summer to look at what you know, the advantages, disadvantages, implications of moving to a single institutional accreditation for the university system. It's a very complex issue. I don't want to hide behind complexity at all. I generally, when people say it's complex, I say I want to probe. You know, well, why is it complex? What's going on there? But in any sense, I got the study done. I would commend it. It's an excellent piece of work to look at the implications of a single accreditation. The Regents got that report, went through that report, saw some of the positives there, but also saw some of the negatives. And one of the big questions in that process, well, one is that it hasn't happened across the country, where an institution has gone from multiple accreditations to a single, and so it's uncharted territory, which raises uncertainty and the fear of loss of institutional accreditation, which is critical not only as a quality assurance matter, but second, qualification for federal student support and other federal grants and contracts. So it's not something to trifle with at all. In addition to that, there was concern that if we have one set of standards that applies to three very different universities, would that diminish excellence of each one of the three schools in its unique areas of distinctive strength? And so that was a concern that was raised. So the Regents at this point, they have a study, and it is, I'll emphasize this, at this time, or for now, I think Chair Heckman was the chair of the time, said we're putting this on the shelf, but we know exactly where it is. They asked me my view of that, and my recommendation to them was to put it on the shelf for now and work through the strategic pathways process, because there's a lot of work we can do, efficiencies that we can gain, particularly on the administrative side, within the construct of three institutional accreditations. It's when you really get into the academic world that it starts getting problematic. But on the administrative side, the accreditors really don't express great concerns if you have one learning management system, one IT organization, one finance organization, that sort of thing. Much less concerned about that. And we're working with colleagues in Maine. They are actually going through a very similar process. They're a couple of years ahead of us, and they've been doing some real interesting work in terms of consolidating administrative structures across their university system within the construct of multiple institutional accreditations.
Thank you, Mr. President. And when that study is available, would you provide the committee with it if we could see it?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it is available, and we'll get you copies. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Begich.
President Johnson, this is just a follow-up on the land grant issue, and I just was wondering if I could get the citation for, I mean, the you know, the legal citation for that decision, and who litigated it?
Through the chair, Senator Begich, SEAC, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, I believe, is who filed the case that ended up in the 2009 decision. If I could, in addition to the citation there, we've got an information package that, if I may, we'd be happy to provide members of the committee.
Yes, you can provide that. Did you have a follow-up, Senator?
Yeah, very, just quickly, so SEAC, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, were the ones who did that, and they did it because of timber issues. Is that a good guess on my part? Or
through the chair, Senator Begich, you'll have to ask them. They're close by, I think. So.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, let's continue. We aren't even halfway through, so we probably ought to pick up the pace a little bit if you could.
That sounds great. Happy to. We've talked about revenue, and I would note as well here on the revenue side that there are many tax credits in Alaska, exploration, production, oil, gas, et cetera. There's also a higher education income tax credit in the state. That law sunsets December of 2018. It has been very, very valuable for the university. There are members of this panel who have been instrumental in improving that program over the years, and it has strengthened our relationship with businesses across the state. Fishing industry in particular has been really supportive. The mining industry has again been very generous, finance as well. So we can address that in more detail at a later time, but that is definitely a priority for us moving forward. I won't dwell on this. It's pretty depressing. This looks at our funnel, and Alaskans talk about our brain drain. They refer to the 16 roughly Alaskans who leave the state for college, but if you look at the 29 plus the 40, that's really the gusher that's happening in Alaska every single year. So this really heightens the importance of that strong relationship with K-12 and strengthening readiness for college or work of our high school graduates, strengthening our work within the University of Alaska, and then also working more closely to your point, Madam Chair, with employers and really understanding the workforce needs of the state. This is the scale certainly means that this is a pretty sharp decline here, but you get a view of the decline, historic decline in high school graduates in the state. And that's just one of our sources, of course, of students, high school students, but returning students and adults with some college, no degree, are out there as well, no question about it. But these folks are absolutely part of our solution going forward. This is a comparison of Alaska. It's a little bit dated data, but it's based on decennial census data, and the last time we did it, of course, was 2010. And when I look at charts like this across the state, and I'll bet this is the case with you as well when you're at NCSL meetings or whatever, you look for Alaska at one end or the other, not because they're alphabetized. Here we are on the end here with a low percentage of associate's degree attainment of Alaskans born in the state. Here you see 25 to 64-year-olds with college degrees, associate and higher, and here we're at 37%. Going forward, 2025, we need 65. That's what the economy needs. So we've got a big lift going forward. Educational attainment and income. I mentioned that a little while ago. There we are in that lower right-hand cell, low college attainment, high personal income. And the stats nerds there will know that you can draw a line through all of those states, all those data points there, and that's a regression line. And regression is not just a technique to understand correlation and causation, it's also a law. Over time, you regress to the mean. It's just a matter of where and when on that line you're gonna move. So the existential question that concerns me and others at the university, is Alaska going to move up through increased educational attainment so that we can protect the income we've got, or are we going to move to the left? I certainly vote for moving up. That's why I'm here, and I know you all would support that as well, or at least I hope so. Looks at same relationship, basically, a little bit different data, but same relationship, and there we are another, again, as an outlier here, off that line. And so do we move over with educational levels like New Hampshire, Virginia, Minnesota, etc., or do we move down? And I certainly vote for moving to the right. We've talked about this, so I don't think I need to go into that. You're well aware of our budget situation here. This is general fund. Over the last several years, our high year there was 375. We're now at 325, and the governor's request this year is at 325. The regents, I would note, have a budget request of 341 on the operating side and then 50 on the capital side for deferred maintenance. I don't believe there's anything in the governor's budget for deferred maintenance. Well, what have we done over the last couple of years? A lot of impacts on us. Over 900 positions have been eliminated. Quite a few degree programs are either under review or suspended or eliminated. We started, when I started here, about 478 degree programs, so we're looking at heading to about 425 right now, and then we're continuing to look at low enrollment, high cost degree programs all across the system. Demand is another factor, of course, as well, that we consider when we look at a program, and also whether they're redundant programs. So if we have two of something or three of something, can we eliminate one or two of them and then use educational technology to provide access to that program at other places across the state, as opposed to having multiple programs? Lots of administrative consolidation. I mentioned the reductions in statewide, and that's happened on the campuses as well. To try to protect the core mission of the institution. Close some learning centers, which pains us because we are literally the path to opportunity for people in many, many communities. I visited Shishamaref this year, and it was a sad note to walk by the building that used to be the University of Alaska in that community. It sends a pretty powerful and negative message to folks. You know, travel brought that down. You know, all the sort of obvious things that you can control, we have. Another negative impact is reducing some of the startup and seed availability funding for research faculty, and this at a time when the other universities across the country are actually improving in their financial conditions. So competition for our top research faculty is up. We were able to achieve through a bidding of our telecommunications contract over $1 million per year reduction in cost. And then we're also moving folks back onto campus, selling buildings, reducing lease space, defeasing debt, and that sort of thing to try to bring down the cost of our facilities. Looking forward, you know, it's pretty easy to get bogged down in today and the fires of today, but we really think it's important to look forward. We're going to be here 100 years from now, and we want to have our successors around this table 100 years from now celebrate the decisions that were made 100 years before. And so looking out, 2025, that 65% number is our goal. Georgetown University has a very distinguished institute that looks at states and their workforce needs, educational needs, and they're the ones who said, hey, Alaska, you need 65%. This is very common across the states. Most of them are like this. The state's Commission on Post-Secondary Education has adopted this goal, as has the Board of Regents. Today, as you saw that graph a little while ago, we're at 37, so we've got a heavy lift over the next number of years. Some of your colleagues in this building asked, but that's so, I mean, is that possible? Are you really going to be able to accomplish that? And my answer was pretty simple. Do we have a choice? And my view is no. I mean, we can either slowly bleed to death, or we can actually set an ambitious goal and go after it, even though we're experiencing tough times. And I think that Alaskans are gritty people, and we're persistent and tough, and we know that it's a state of opportunity, and so we're going to go after it. And the regents are very supportive of this, as are folks all across our university system.
I know I'm asking you to keep up a good pace, but can you give us a specific one or two action steps that have changed because of that goal?
Well, one is, and there are slides that deal with our enrollment planning. We're going after Alaskans. You may have heard on the radio now and seen on social media, we have a public awareness campaign going to really try to lift up higher education and the University of Alaska in particular in the eyes of Alaskans. More aggressive recruiting efforts out there to try to really encourage people to come our way. So those are a couple of examples we're pushing on. Also, really interesting work on that 115,000 Alaskans with some college and no degree. That's a big, huge market segment to go after. And they're not, frankly, going to quit their jobs and come onto our campuses and take classes Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 to 11:30. It's not going to happen in this Amazon.com world. They need courses that are asymmetrically delivered, they can download, they can take them on their time, that are convenient, that transfer across our university system. We've got to become much more nimble and flexible and student-centric there to go after that market. And so we're pushing on that one hard. That's how we're going to hit that number.
And I saw a University of Alaska commercial during the Super Bowl. That must have been part of the effort as well.
Yes, it is. And it didn't show in Florida. It was just here in Alaska. So, and again, with private funds. And so.
Senator Stevens?
Madam Chair, I know you want to get through this, but I've gone through all of the slides. I don't see anything about a question I need to ask. And as a retired faculty member, I'm quite concerned that the faculties at Fairbanks and Anchorage have given you a vote of no confidence. Mm-hmm. I know you're in a tough spot. We have been challenging you by cutting your budget. I believe the regents are supportive of where you're going with strategic pathways. I applaud you. I think you made the right decision on moving the School of Education headquarters here to the Juneau campus. But still in all, as a former faculty member, I am quite concerned of where you're going in relationship to the faculty. How are you going to bring them into the process? They apparently feel they've been left out. Both Senates have said that of the strategic pathways. The faculty is extremely important. How do we bridge that gap? How are you going to bridge that gap?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you for asking that question. It's an excellent question. One is these are, I respect the faculty senates, no doubt about it. Diversity of viewpoints is critically important. I would note the strategic pathways process already has included over 250 faculty, staff, students, and community leaders, 89 faculty, many of whom were governance leaders, served on the teams themselves. So there's been a lot of faculty involvement there. Second, there have been constructive suggestions made by faculty in terms of improving the strategic pathways process, and we are already implementing a number of those suggestions. So, for example, in phase one of strategic pathways, in addition to having faculty on the teams, I thought, well, let's have public forums, and let's invite faculty, students, and others in. And a couple of our campuses, we had roughly 400 people show up to these public forums. But interestingly, they, and you know this from your work in having town halls and that sort of thing, they can get taken over, basically. And so instead of folks standing up and talking about teacher education or research administration or IT or procurement, they talked about sports at both UAA and UAF. Understood. So going forward, there will be two rounds of consultation with every affected organizational unit in phase two. So yours truly is going to be all over the place. Prior to my even reviewing the options with the Board of Regents in March, I will have had meetings with every faculty staff member who's affected by the options that are being considered. And then after just reviewing options with the Regents in March, I will be back out and again meeting on the campuses with all of those faculty, staff, students in those specific areas for their input. In addition to that, we're scheduling time with the faculty senates themselves so that they have an opportunity to weigh in. Change is very, very difficult. There is a sense of urgency. You're not waiting. You can't wait to make decisions here. Right? At least I don't think so. And you've given us budgets that are tough to meet, and I can't take 7 years to go through processes to make decisions about how we're going to move forward. We have to make those decisions expeditiously. Making sausage in public it's hard. There's no question about it. And I would note that there's a lot of support from a lot of faculty across the university system who are seeing progress and are seeing positive movement. So that said, I'm listening to the faculty. They are absolutely critical to our mission. And we will have, I would note as well, at the March Regents meeting, a focused session on shared governance. So we'll be talking about our various roles and responsibilities there.
Thank you, Mr. President. Madam Chair, there's an old joke that I didn't like when I was a professor, and that is how many professors does it take to change a light bulb? Well, the answer is change. But I say that in humor because I love the faculty and the faculty senates. I appreciate what they've done. I appreciate what you're doing, and we can get beyond this, I believe. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'll just add that at a recent town hall before the beginning of the legislative session, I had students and university staff come and speak in support of this process. So, and actually none that were negative about it. So.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I mean, I respect our faculty tremendously, and there's no question it hurts. I would not be honest with you if I didn't admit that. And we will absolutely do better. It is a learning process. It is an evolving process. I certainly want to make sure that our faculty are engaged and contributing. So thank you very much for the question. Well, we've talked quite a bit about this. The commissioner and I, the Johnson and John Sen slide, are working together. The regents and the Board of Education are working together. He and I have co-presented a number of times at the State Chamber and other. There was a nice piece in the Anchorage Daily News here recently about our work together. So this is just really important. And instead of pointing fingers at each other, it's all about working together with each other to align what we're doing in their K-12 with what we're doing in higher education, and also, importantly, the workforce piece as well out in the economy. The research says that the single most important factor in a K-12 student's success outside of the school, because that's where actually most of the impact comes from, is whether there's a job in the home. And so if we can create jobs in homes and create students who are ready to learn in K-12 and have great teachers in those classrooms, then I think we'll have a cycle here that'll be very, very strong for our state moving forward. So that's when I talk about building a culture of education in Alaska, that's what we're all about. So a number of specifics here of the work we're doing, and perhaps if you have any questions here, I'll keep moving. I guess something I'd really like to highlight, though, is ambitious goal, yes, but let's produce 90% of the state's teachers every year by 2025. We're at 30 now. Let's really ramp that up and own that. That preparation, and I think we will see lots of benefits in higher education and in K-12 education that Alaskans are teaching our young people. That's not to be critical of people who come in from outside Alaska to teach, but we need to grow our own here.
We've had a lot of conversation here since the session began in this committee about virtual education and the opportunities that we might be able to offer, particularly for rural students, more coursework and the cream of the crop teachers. Are you doing anything in your teacher training program for that type of model, or is it more traditional brick and mortar? Because I understand that it actually takes different skills. It's a little bit different when you're facing a camera and dealing with the students. I'm just wondering if that's a component.
Madam Chair, it absolutely is. We do faculty development on the use of IT, and there's a lot of great work going on in that area. I would note, particularly in terms of teacher preparation, that one of our, we have many wonderful programs, but one of them actually is based here at the University of Alaska Southeast. And in order to get a Master of Arts in Teaching, you already have to have a disciplinary degree. You come here for a six-week period, and then you're out actually teaching in the classroom, supported by a senior mentor, master teacher, and taking coursework online while you're in CAIC or Shishmaref. So a lot of that work is being done as we speak. Now, we need to step up a program, production of more programs, and there's a lot of good work that's being done on that front across the university system, but more and more of that is needed, no question about it.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you have, at the university, a RAN program, Rural Recruitment of Alaska Native Nurses.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have an analogous program in education programs? And by the way, it's not teacher training, it's teacher education. Puppies and ponies are trained. Teachers are educated.
Okay.
Just a side point. But back to the rural teachers.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I take your point on training, although when I was in graduate school at one of the world's best universities, they talked to us about being trained. we're training graduate students in political science, but that's fine. So I take your point. We do have a Future Educators of Alaska program where we're reaching out into seventh grade and trying to recruit young people to the profession, and we'll step up more of that. We've talked about an Alaska Native teacher education program based in part on the ANSEP program, and actually we're working with ANSEP to steer some of those folks into teaching. Because actually, as you know well, disciplinary degrees are really important, and if we have students getting those Master of Arts degrees in teaching who have a biology degree, maybe through the ANSEP program, or a math degree, maybe through the ANSEP program, we're going to have a better teacher out there eventually. So it is, we're reaching out, you know, into those, because you can't just grow a teacher when they show up on your campus. You've got to reach out and bring them in. Now, I also want to note, it's part of our media program here, that I just last week announced a scholarship for a young person who they go through an application process, tuition scholarship, if they want to become a teacher for Alaska. And I'd like to actually turn that program up over time to really generate some excitement about our support for teaching, and really try to, hard thing to do, raise the prestige of this most important profession all across our state.
Senator Begich.
President Johnson, I'd call your attention to the work that former Commissioner Covey and Dr. Armstrong have done in the EQQ study that addresses exactly how they ended up interviewing communities and individuals and teachers all and superintendents all across the state, and came up with a number of findings that show ways that in collaboration with the university we could grow our own here in the state of Alaska, and everything from Future Teachers of America all the way to, you know, which is Future Teachers of Alaska, all the way to specific programmatic changes in the university that might be helpful to.
Through the chair, thanks, Senator Begich. I would note that Mr. Covey was a member of our Strategic Pathways team on teacher education and continues to consult with us. I met with him as recently as late last week because he's a real leader in this field, and he's helping us quite a bit. So thank you for that. Let me talk a little bit about, well, we've got Scholars, the Alaska Scholars Program, which has been a tremendous boon for the university, and that's, you know, that's connected up with a land grant. We pay for those scholarships with proceeds from our land and development of our land. So from land to scholarships and excellence across the university, and of course also the performance scholarship that that the legislature has funded, really making a positive difference for us at the university. Looking forward in terms of investments, student success is number one for us. We've really got to step up our recruitment of students, and retention, critically important. I'd note here some of the real innovation, and you're probably aware of some of this across the country, in the use of predictive analytics and in the use of what we call intrusive advising to make sure that we retain students. And often it's small things that are predictable that result in a student dropping out. Could be that the car is broken, or whatever it might be, there are a number of things that can be addressed, and there's a great deal of success now across the country in being able to say, well, if a student misses, isn't responding to an email from a professor twice, then that's an indicator that they're going to drop out. And so, you know, you get on it and say, okay, Mr. Begich, you haven't responded twice. Come on, let's. We need to hear from you, and we're going to come over and talk to you, and to really sort of get inside you a little bit. And it's working across the country. So we're going to do more of that here, focusing on workforce facility maintenance is a big priority. Always has been. It's got to continue to be. We have over 400 facilities, many of which are the oldest public facilities in Alaska. So a top priority. Research, economic development, I mentioned, and our K-12 partnership. So these are the areas that the Board of Regents has emphasized. They reallocated budget last year into these and have built their budget request this year on these priorities. This graph summarizes, you know, if we start with over on the left-hand side there, $350 million. That was our FY16 general fund appropriation. If you follow the red line down, that's what I regard a hard landing to 325. That's what we received for the current fiscal year. The governor's proposing extending that out. This, the green line there, basically says, okay, state, we understand that it's unsustainable to rely on you to the extent we have historically. What about a gradual glide path to a more sustainable reliance on state support? And so the end out there to the far right, $312 million, that is the national average general fund appropriation per student plus 30%, essentially an Alaska factor, if you will, to reflect our higher cost of living. And as an Alaskan of over 30 years and somebody who does read the paper and pay attention to the challenges that you're all facing, I think we've got to, it's hard in a way to put on a piece of paper that we would propose asking you for less money over time, although it does involve us moving up to the line this year and then gradually declining. But I think that's the right thing to do, and it's a responsible thing to do for our state and for the university. Now, obviously, we've got to fill in over that period of time, and that's going to come from tuition. Right now, we're 19% below the Western states' average tuition. Let's bring that up to the Western states' average, not 1.3, but the average, to ensure continued affordability and access. Let's step up private giving. Hopefully, the higher education income tax credit stays there. Research needs to be there. But the bottom line of this model is enrollment, 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 not only from a mission perspective, but from a financial perspective. We've got to step up enrollment in order to make our ability to moderate our requests from you real and to meet the state's workforce needs. So the Regent's request, again, has us going from 325 and 17 up to 341, and then over time has us coming down. And, of course, this is tied to that 65 by 2025 model. So that's what sort of hangs this together. That's our bright light. That's the light we're steering to across the channel. This, I believe, is a sustainable way of funding that over that period of time.
I'm not going to ask you to answer this now, but I would like to know why the plus 30%. That seems a little high for the national average, so if you could get that back to us.
Yes.
I know there is a difference. We're a large state, but it just seems rather high in how you determined, you know, where did you come up with that additional 30% above
Happy
the national average?
Happy to, Madam Chair. You got it. So a number of enrollment strategies and planning moving forward. This is absolutely critical. We've had these big summits at each one of the universities to understand what they're doing and to encourage them to keep going and do good work on this issue. The fiscal framework I just mentioned to you. We're doing this structured decision making is a scenario planning process that we're going through, and we're really looking at, okay, what are the degrees that would enable us to attract those students and meet the state's workforce needs? What are those certificates? What are those licenses? And how do we build programs that are accessible and cost effective for students? And so that's that work. Invested more money in strategic enrollment planning at the campuses. McDowell is working on more work for us right now, doing a high school survey, and then we're working on a database that basically collects data that the Department of Labor here in the state has collected over time, but due to their budget reductions have not been able to recently. So we see no other option but to go get that data ourselves. So work is going on that front. So recruitment and retention and that big group of Alaskans with some college and no degree, that's critically important for us. And online learning, we've got to get out there and do it well. And we do it well, but it's not just courses, but really degree programs of value for students. We don't need to go through these numbers, but when I mentioned that 115,000, that's at the bottom. It's actually 114,483 you see there. At the bottom of that second chart. So that's the target. So we dig into the adult market here and the segments within the adult market. And then I touch on strategic pathways a bit. We've talked about that here already. I would just note that it's not a plan per se. It is not a vision. I didn't go up to a mountain and get a couple of tablets and come on down and say, hey, this is it at all. This is a discovery process that we're working through. And the framework for it was adopted by the Board of Regents last January, and this sort of sums it up and identifies a number of areas where we're consistent, where we seek unity across the system, and also identifies areas of distinctiveness and focus for each one of our three universities. The upside of this process, like many of the processes that you as state leaders go through, it's open, it's inclusive, it's transparent. A lot of people have been involved, and we're making decisions coming out of it. Downside is it's open, it's inclusive, a lot of people are involved, so there's a lot of complexity of it as well. But and it's decisive, and whenever you make a decision, as you know, somebody's not going to be happy, and we're moving through that. But this is, a very simple, clear picture of what it is we're going through right now. Just in phase one alone, the regents have stepped up and made some serious decisions. We had three research administration offices, one, led by one of our campuses. Three procurement offices, one. We had IT all over the place, consolidated onto each one of the university campuses. These two schools of engineering are doing superb work together, actually built on the collaboration that went into the construction of the two facilities, new facilities at Anchorage and Fairbanks. Those advisory groups meet together. It's fantastic. We at Common, you wouldn't think this would be hard, but they're actually working on, and we'll have this summer done, common course numbers, common course descriptions. They're actually talking to each other about collaborative hiring and courses being offered via video. So there's really just impressive work happening between the schools of engineering and also in management. Very, very good collaboration there, which is one of the, I would just note, one of the big values of this pathways process is just bringing people together and talking about these things. Hey, you know, we could do that. Sure, let's do it. And so that's a real positive. A big one, of course, was consolidating leadership of and creating a college of education serving all of Alaska from three schools of education to one. It's going to be a couple of year process. I just wrote a charge memo out to the chancellors to lay out the what's in scope, schedule, and those sorts of things. I would note, and it's just critically important to reiterate, they're going to be education faculty in Fairbanks. They're going to be education faculty in Anchorage. They're going to be students in Anchorage and Fairbanks and all across the state. We just didn't feel that it was necessary to have three administrations, three deans, three phone numbers our school superintendents need to call. In fact, the Superintendents Association did its own poll, and over 90% of the superintendents said, one school of education, please. So we're really trying to balance here accountability, cost-effectiveness, and access and service to Alaskans. Our nursing program, as you know well, is run out of UAA, but right here in Juneau, you can get a nursing degree from UAA here in Juneau. So this is just phase one here. So decisions have been made. We're moving forward. So I would close and by thanking you for this time. And you've heard me do a lot of talking, and I appreciate your patience here. But I hope you see that we are leaning forward. We are leading. We are making difficult decisions. We are listening, and we'll do better at including all of our people, no doubt about it. But we're clear about our bottom line. It's to serve Alaska. It's to serve our students, number one. And it's been a pleasure to have this time with you. I'm happy to answer any questions given the little time we may have, and happy to follow up at your convenience to continue talking about our great university.
Well, we are at just about time, so if members do have questions, you can submit them to me, and I'll pass them on to President Johnson. I want to thank you very much. I want to thank you for your leadership. And what I see, these are challenges, but you are turning them into opportunities. And I believe that if done properly, we'll actually improve the quality. More students will be attracted to the university. I don't think when we do these kind of hard things, it has to lessen the quality. I believe it really has a potential in an odd way to really increase the quality. And so I applaud your efforts, and I know it's hard, and I ask any faculty across the state that are listening in to get involved in a greater degree. I thank you for your question, Senator Stevens. I actually had that on my list for the end, so thank you for bringing that. And with that, I just want to let you know, committee members, that on Friday we'll have a joint meeting with a presentation from two school districts who are leading the way in virtual education in Alaska, and I believe it'll be a very informative and exciting presentation. So looking forward to that. And we will adjourn at 9:29 a.m.